Welcome to Narratology. Each episode will offer unique insights and perspectives from people countering the narrative. We seek to tell stories that bring a critical lens to the events shaping our present and our past. We will bring activists, artists, influencers, advocates, and innovators to you, and together engage in powerful discussions. I'm your host, Charles Stevens.
Hello, everyone. I'm Charles Stevens, and I'm the host of this podcast. And I'm joined with someone that I've admired for many years and someone has had, I think, a really profound impact on my life and my journey. And that person is Reverend Duncan Teague. Reverend Duncan Teague. Hey, Duncan.
Hey, Charles. Thank you for having me. And thanks for the counter narrative, having this forum.
Absolutely.
I'm so proud of the counter narrative. We're recording this a little bit before y'all are going to hear it, so I'm feeling kind of holly jolly.
Yes. So this was probably one of the most difficult podcasts that I've had to record because, you know, Reverend Teague has so much amazing history and stories. So I guess it's both a good thing and also like a really challenging thing to figure what, in terms of Atlanta and Atlanta's story, like where do we focus? And I just remember him telling me about, and that's funny. I think we haven't talked extensively about this part of his story, but I remember learning from him and others that he was the first black outreach worker at Aid Atlanta.
Yes.
So just really, I mean, ultimately, and like
first black gay outreach worker at Aid Atlanta.
At Aid Atlanta. And that's really important. And that's where we kind of landed. I've also sometimes referred to him as our very own Iman. I think the lineage was Duncan was going to be Iman and Craig Washington was going to be Naomi Campbell. The pantheon of models.
If they had only paid
That. Maybe you would be Beverly Johnson and maybe Craig would be Iman.
Mm. And that would mean that I would go on to marry David Bowie and have his child who's a movie star now.
Not a bad life, huh?
Not a bad life.
So Reverend Teague is here to just share some of his. I'm just going to leave it pretty open, but I just want to hear from you just about. Tell me how you found your way to Aid Atlanta as a staff person and just as much of that as you can share with our audience about that experience. And also the year that you became, the year and the month, if possible, that you got involved.
Okay, I go back this far with Aid Atlanta, and I need to, like, be as humble, that's how my folks pronounced it, as possible about it because I was not the first black gay person at Aid Atlanta. J.R. Finney, who's now an MCC minister in Birmingham, Alabama, was already on the board, if I'm not mistaken. And Chuck Cummings was on the helpline. And Kenny Marshall, who is deceased, a former attorney who was born and bred here in the Atlanta area, was already doing legal advice. These were all African-American gay men. Chuck is in Los Angeles and hopefully finishing up his novel. I'm naming these people because all these black gay men were already involved in the baby Aid Atlanta. Howsoever, when in October of 1985, they held the AIDS 101 weekend workshop. It was a whole weekend, starting Friday night, Saturday most of the day, and Sunday afternoon. And we were at All Saints Episcopal.
In Midtown?
In Midtown. And so in 85, we're only 3 years after the first recorded cases of HIV, and we're in the throes of the beginning epidemic in Atlanta because Atlanta falls 18 months after San Francisco and New York. So we can no longer pretend like the epidemic is not facing our southern haven of gay life because too many men are starting to be diagnosed. So the epidemic is present. It's present in gay organizations because friends are getting sick. And in October of 85, we don't have a test for HIV or, in the parlance of the day, a test for AIDS. And if there were a test, nobody would have wanted to take it because there was no cure. So why would you want to know that you have a terminal disease or disease that's going to make your life, end your life possibly too soon? You don't want to know. And it's still being thought of as a gay disease and an IV drug user's disease by then. And I think we'd gotten over the Haitian thing. I hope we had by then. But you can check the records for that. So I did the whole AIDS 101 weekend, and a lot of it was very personal. I'm trying to make myself sound as human as possible because I didn't grow up with, you know, a lead cape to protect me from kryptonite and all that kind of stuff. I was a small black queen who moved here after I graduated college in 84. By October of 85, I am cohabitating with my boyfriend, Roger, and Roger had moved here from San Francisco. And so I was concerned. And one of the big things about that weekend is that I came home and tried to introduce safer sex into a relationship that had already existed. And Roger was like, why do we have to do this? Because we're going to be monogamous. And he had all these thoughts about what our relationship would do to protect us. And we didn't know if one of us was HIV positive. Well, I started volunteering with the education department, I think it was, or whatever they called it back then.
Do you remember your volunteer process? Like, who interviewed you? Did you fill out an application? Like,
It was, you know, I signed up at 101 with the education department because I had my degree in theater. I thought I could use my big mouth to help. And I didn't want to do the buddy program. Mm. I didn't want to do the buddy program. And I wasn't confident in my skills at that moment in time about being with somebody who was dying. I didn't know how I can handle that. And this is a 20-something-year-old Duncan. Or was I a teenager? Anyway.
I think you might have been 9 or something.
A 20-something, yeah, because I already told you I graduated college and, you know, and I was not a child prodigy. But anyway, so the next year they found funding. Okay, and the AIDS Atlanta that we're talking about was awash in trying to provide something for people who had been diagnosed with AIDS. And trying to keep up with what research was available and the onslaught of homophobic, terminal illness phobic responses from public health, from the government, from all of that. So really, AID Atlanta is a subset of the queer community trying to respond to the local epidemic.
Where was AID Atlanta located at this time?
On Crescent Street, across the street from the Gallus, in a one-story building that was a block away from the backside of First Baptist Church, from one of their annex buildings. I don't even think the building still exists now. And Crescent Street was known as a street where young men and not-so-young men worked the street in the afternoon and evening to work as sex workers and to, you know, get by. It had a long reputation for that.
How are you received at AIDS Atlanta? So you signed up to volunteer.
My friends from, especially back then, from Black and White Men Together Atlanta, were all over the agency, as I just named the names. And so they were pushing and welcoming me all at the same time into this position that they had found money for.
Were you hyper aware of your blackness in that space? Or how did you
aware of my blackness?
Like, how did you negotiate the space as a black gay man?
I think that I was conscious of the fact that I was black and gay, but in the context of the epidemic at that moment, I think I was more conscious of the fact that I was a young man who was in love with a man from San Francisco and that I had found queer community and felt free for the first time, and that freedom was being threatened by this epidemic. And that there was something we could do based on what I had learned at AIDS 101 a year before, and that was that we could wear condoms. And that if we wore condoms and protected each other, we could help stop the epidemic. And I thought that, well, we'll have a cure in about 2 or 3 years, and I'll go back to the theater, because I was doing survival work. At that moment in time, was I waiting tables? I think I was waiting tables.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, yeah. I was a waiter at Clarence Foster's on Peachtree Street, across the street from Piedmont Hospital, where McNeely's was. And there was another really happening bar for white heterosexuals who liked Miller Lite and Bud Light. And it was called the Bermuda Triangle at Collier and Peachtree.
It seems like you were there's an optimism, but I'm also curious, Duncan, were you terrified? Were you afraid?
Yes, I was scared. And I went into all of this believing I had to be HIV positive.
How did you cope?
By being involved. I thought, well, if I have it, I'm going to go down fighting. And I was out, which was a very big deal. I was not closeted. And I was very proud of the fact that I was not closeted because I had come out in high school. So by 86, I've been out more than 10 years or almost 10 years because I was a junior in high school when I came out.
Yeah, we talked a bit about homophobia. And I guess that's what I was getting at around asking about like how you navigated the space around race.
Oh, what I had to become aware of, and I'm not sure this is what you're after, but what I had to become aware of was that the freedom I enjoyed as an out black gay man who was not working a job where my income was threatened by my sexuality, whose religion was not threatened by that because I was away from home and trying to figure out what I would do spiritually. And I had been involved with MCC, or Metropolitan Community Christian Church. And at that time, First MCC was on Highland Avenue. And I was met there by dear friends, and one of them was Reverend Carolyn Mobley. And we sang together, and we did work together in the community. Really, Atlanta opened its arms to me wherever I went. Part of it was that I wasn't from Atlanta, so I didn't walk in afraid. I wasn't worried about who was going to out me because I was already out. And so I walked through the world like that. Now, what I soon became faced with was that Atlanta was a segregated community. There was this pocket of interracial dating, interracial social action, but for the most part, the white boys went here, the black boys went there. And I'm going to be really frank, that never pleased me because that wasn't how I lived my life. But because I'm trying to get messages out to black and white men and other men of color, in those days, I wasn't as concerned about other men of color, but certainly black and white men about the epidemic and just about the reality that if we will use condoms, that's what was in my head. Because remember, I am believing that there is going to be a cure in 2 or 3 years so I can go back to the theater. I realized I had to become comfortable in code switching, comfortable in developing messages that would work in environments that I wasn't typically in. I had to go back and learn how to sound a little more closeted.
So could you say more about, let's get into that. Okay. Yeah, when you say it's a little more closeted and code switching, could you say a little bit more about that?
Okay. If you're black in America, you know how to talk at home at dinner time, Sunday dinner. You know how to talk at church, which may not be exactly how you talk at home. That's code switching. You know how to talk at school, which is not the way you talk at church, which is not the way you talk at home. You know how to talk at the barbershop, which is not the way you talk at home, which is not the way you talk at church, which is not the way you talk at school. We learn which language we're going to access and how to access it. When is it okay to let my Southern accent out? When is it okay to let my Midwestern accent out? When is it okay to sound like I have had a private school education since I was in sixth grade? When is it really cool to not do that? And so I had to learn that here in Atlanta because in certain environments, if I didn't use the right language, my message isn't going to get out.
Did you experience any racism in your early HIV movement work, direct racism versus structural? I mean, obviously there's structural racism, so I want to make that distinction, but like very direct microaggressions around being black that you remember?
I don't remember in specific white gay or lesbian people standing in my way. And I'm going to say this, particular to that time, we had so much homophobia and internalized fear of our own sexuality in the black community. There were black institutions didn't want to talk about AIDS, didn't want to talk about gay, didn't want AID Atlanta to come near them because we were not ready in 86, 87 for any of this. And you ask about racism, and I started talking about issues that I had in my own community. Because emotionally for me, I came from Kansas City, where it was just as segregated socially and where the Midwestern racism is not as overt, at least it used to not be, as the Southern, but it was there. And so they were just a little more polite about it. But they didn't want to be bothered. So I was accustomed to it. So asking me about my discomfort means, well, that means you didn't know that you were going to face it. Well, I did know. And I knew which bars to go to and which ones not to go to. And which ones to go to with which associates. Because I went everywhere. Because I was here in Atlanta and I was out and I was free and I was going to be Duncan.
Did you feel a lot of pressure? So you're hired in 86 as the Black gay man working in the movement,
yes,
doing outreach. Did you feel a lot of pressure to show up a certain way? I know you talked about code switching, but in a sense,
yes,
you are, I mean, you're a very visible leader.
And I did feel pressure to sometimes dial back some of Duncan so that I could effectively do what I needed to do and not wear a young Duncan outfit to the wrong occasion because I didn't want to be ushered out. I was doing an educational workshop in one of the projects here.
Do you remember what side of town it was on?
It was way south, as I remember, and it was humongous. And Aid Atlanta allowed me to go do it. I think it was one of those cases where the Black outreach worker was not able to do it that day. We all had our day jobs because we were all part-time.
Oh.
Yeah, these are not full-time paid positions with salary and benefit. No. The only people who had that were the social worker and the executive director.
Do you remember how much you made? Are you willing to share?
I don't remember, and it wasn't that much. It was a little more than volunteering. But it was okay because I was willing to do it to stop the epidemic. And really, as crazy as it's going to sound, I thought I could help stop the epidemic.
So you were headed to this housing projects in the South to do a workshop.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there were children there. And back then I wore my hair longer and permed and I had a bob. And so my gender was not as, you could question my gender from looking at me at a distance. Once I opened my mouth, of course, it was obvious I was male. And I was small. I was small and cute.
You were the pioneer for the Black twinks.
Thank you. And this man came in and took all the boys out of the workshop because he did not want an out homosexual influencing the boys from the projects. Now, this is real irony, and this deserves its own PhD examination. Why did he leave somebody who he thought was threatening to the boys in the room with the girls? Why was it more important to protect the girls from HIV than the boys? Why didn't he talk to the women about removing me completely and rescheduling? It was just so weird.
What was this man? Like, what was his role?
I think he was just a parent or something.
Like a parent.
He took all the boys out of the workshop.
Did anyone protest that?
Nobody did. Nobody stood up to him.
How did the girls react to you?
You know, they were just fine. And the boys actually were fine with me, too, until he arrived.
Duncan, thank you for sharing that piece. I want to pivot a bit to a question that's been in my mind as you've been talking, and that is, what was the local response in Atlanta at that time? So I believe this was 85. Andrew Young was the mayor?
Yes.
The mayor at the time, and the city council. What was your take on the response from the local leadership?
Okay.
What was happening?
The governor said he did not want to hear the word AIDS or the word gay. A brochure that was targeted at the leather community was photocopied, because everything was photocopied back then. And a number...
You may have to describe for our millennial and Generation Z listeners what photocopy meant.
It was not mimeographed. It was Xeroxed at Kinko's. Kinko's used to be what FedEx is now. But anyway, somebody went to a copy machine and made enough copies of a brochure that was targeted at the leather community, which, by the way, has always been responsive to the epidemic. That's something we don't say out loud enough. And that leather sex done correctly was never going to put anybody at risk because it was safe, sane, and consensual. And they talked about what they were going to do. They didn't just do it. But anyway, this brochure, which had on the cover a fist for obvious reasons, was photocopied, and a copy of the brochure was folded and put on every legislator's desk at the Capitol. And this was prior to a vote for funding that would have helped Aid Atlanta.
Do you know who the legislator was that did this, or the person?
I don't know. But it didn't matter because This was the sentiment that they were going to not care about us dying.
Was it Bill McKinney, Cynthia McKinney's father? Was he in the legislature at that time? Do you remember him? The reason why I bring him up because I heard, and I've not been able to verify this. So allegedly, I believe he was actually behind a quarantine bill, but I heard that, but I don't have.
I would ask you to verify that.
Okay.
Because you can in the record, because if he put it out there, it's out there in the public record.
And this was also the year, I believe 86 was the year that there was an election between John Lewis and Julian Bond. Do you remember HIV come up in that election?
I don't remember it coming up. I remember us being more afraid of it coming up than people being silent. Because if they were silent, then there was an opportunity to possibly influence them. But if it came up, it was going to be negative.
Yeah.
And at the time, Ambassador Young, who I have great respect for, was not what we would consider pro-gay.
Really?
Or pro-HIV.
Mm.
And you can check the record, but it's my memory that he had grave issues with the burgeoning gay community and all the stuff that was happening around the epidemic.
Wow. Were there any elected officials that were supportive at the time on city council or any kind of other school board, Fulton County Commission? Who are our friends? Were there any friends?
We had to have had them. I don't remember them.
Yeah.
In 86, not everybody could claim they had lost somebody or knew somebody with HIV. And remember that for many people, the cure for HIV, as far as they were concerned, was don't become gay. Don't choose to be gay, because of course it was a choice.
Do you remember any faith leaders that were supportive?
Outside of the gay community?
Particularly in the Black community.
There is a long period of silence for those listening.
Mm. And Duncan,
which I'm sure they're going to have to edit out, but I'm having a hard time. This was when, and you'll have to check the history on this, this was when Charles Stanley, who was not only pastor of the largest Southern Baptist church in Atlanta, First Baptist, which at that point was on Peachtree, but he was also president of the Southern Baptist Union or the Southern Baptist Convention. When he said that AIDS was the result of the sin of homosexuality, it was the consequences of the sin of homosexuality. That's what he said from the pulpit. And our response was to hold prayer about him in a circle that surrounded the church. That was one of the proudest things I've ever done, was be in that prayer circle for him and his AIDS phobia and his homophobia. We literally were fighting for our lives, not for the concept of our freedom, but literally for our right to be alive and to be treated with an illness as any other sick person would expect to be treated. I did not witness this, but I had it on good authority that some HIV and AIDS patients who were young men were not afforded their food brought to them in Grady. The trays were left outside the door. I know for a fact, because I did visit this person, there was a woman with HIV whose doctor was smart enough not to put it on her chart. The nurses were feeding her because she was a Black woman with children and a Pentecostal minister. And so she couldn't have been in the hospital for AIDS. So they're in the room feeding her and talking about the gay men across the hall. And of course, universal precautions weren't being used. So they were actually threatening themselves, and not by feeding her, but by doing medical things to her without using the proper protections. It was an insane time to be attempting to do what I was trying to do with a Bachelor of Arts in theater.
How'd you keep going?
Because I was determined to help my folks out.
Like, I know you probably had many moments where you wanted to give up or you felt despair.
Like, oh, no, because we were going to find a cure and we were going to live until we found a cure.
Did you ever want to walk away?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'll say this publicly now. The times when I have wanted to walk away were not from outside oppression. It was from inside oppression. When we wouldn't stand with each other in a way that was loving and affirming and productive for ourselves. Because if you have your family, if you have your friends surrounding you, you'll face anything. But if you look around and you don't feel like you have support of the people who look like you, love you, care for you, say they support you, or they're engaged in activities or behavior that you find immoral, unethical, It's hard to find the strength to do something phenomenal.
Just one last question, and thank you so much for this candid talk. There's so many more things I want to talk to you about. We'll have to do a part two. But if you could just share just any advice you would give to today's activists. And I recognize that you're very much a part of the activist landscape, so I'm not trying to usher you. I mean, you're still very much a part. But what advice or what best practices can you offer?
Oh, this is not hard at all. Because a decision I made, I'm not like Asoto, who said he lived with no regret.
And that's Asoto Saint?
Asoto Saint, who was a personal friend.
Mm.
I have a profound regret, and that's that in 1986, when I got the call from, I believe, Ken South, who was executive director of AID Atlanta, Reverend Ken South, who, by the way, was ushered out of Concerned Black Clergy about HIV. And at that moment, Sandra McDonald was on the board of AID Atlanta, and Sandra McDonald thought that she had the influence to go to Concerned Black Clergy. They wouldn't usher Sandra out because they were afraid of doing that. But they artfully would not schedule her or would unschedule her to speak. That's the atmosphere that we were facing. But in 1986, when Ken made that call to tell me that, Duncan, we indeed are going to hire you as our Black gay outreach worker, I was so happy and I was so thrilled with it. And I had a voice lesson that day, a brand new voice lesson with someone I had never worked with. I canceled the lesson. Don't cancel your voice lesson for the sake of the cause, whatever the cause is. Don't cancel your voice lesson. Don't cancel your date with somebody you think will be loving and supportive of you, even if they don't understand the cause that you're fighting. Keep yourself and the things that will uphold you and keep you together at the top of the list. Make sure that you're mentally, physically, spiritually taken care of so that you have something to come home to at the end of the protest, at the end of the meeting, at the end of whatever the, I guess nowadays it's the podcast. But put together those things that uphold you and don't give up your art or your writing or your poetry or your whatever, because those are the things that help sustain me all these years, even though I started so very, very, very young.
Very young.
Very young. But those things are some of the things that I'm most proud of and the things that have really kept me going. And so I understand we had a conversation off air about somebody that Charles was researching and that from his hospital bed, he was trying to write poetry. He was trying to put his words out there. And I get it now because the poetry might help save not only him more than probably at that time all we had was AZT. Which, by the way, was so strong and we were given so much of the people that permed our hair. It was crazy. And that was all we had. And maybe some other things, a few drugs, but nothing like today. And so it's that art, that philosophy, that intellectual whatever that gets you up in the morning. Don't give that stuff up. You may have to put it to the side, but it stays on the plate.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. That was Reverend Duncan Teague, and please...
Founder of Abundant Love Unitarian Universalist please. Congregation of Atlanta.
Say it one more time. Tell us address, service, if you want to get another dose.
A shameless plug, because...
Ain't sense enough to be shamed.
This one, there's a little bit of shame involved, but just a little bit. That my last calling was into ministry. And I was helped and assisted and loved into founding Abundant Love Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Southwest Atlanta. And we meet at the Hammonds House Museum most Sundays at 10:30. And it's alove.org. And we spell love with the UU in it because we are Unitarian Universalists. So it's ALUUV.org.
All right. Thank you so much, Reverend Teague, and please follow the Counter Narrative Project on Facebook and Instagram at The Counter Narrative and on Twitter at Building Desire.